Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the White Collar Factory. I'm Damien Wild, and I'm editor of EG. It's great to see so many of you here. And it seems fitting to end one of the most tumultuous years of recent memory, well, at least since 2016, with an event in the Capitol's most anticipated new building. And I know those of you who were able to join us on a tour of the building were simply blown away earlier. It really is quite something. And I do hope that tonight's event, like the building itself, lives up to its promise. So if 2016 ushered in Brexit and Trump, 2017 has continued to deliver no shortage of column inches on either. This year has added the spice of an unlikely election result. And it's fair to say that politicians have done little to inject certainty into the property market. Some seem to have concluded that they can better connect with an increasingly sceptical public by going as far away from Westminster as can be imagined. So we've seen one party leader, former party leader Ed Miliband, reinvent himself and reveal a previously suppressed personality as a Radio 2 DJ. And another, Kezia Dugdale, has fled to the Australian jungle. And don't pretend you don't know what I'm talking about there. I'm sure you watch such lowbrow telly as well. So what will 2018 bring? Well, you know, for sports fans, the Commonwealth Games, the Winter Olympics and the World Cup, and glorious failure by the England team all but guaranteed. The property industry will be hoping for stability, opportunity and continued inward investment. And on the political front, May's London elections could shock. And in lunar news, two space tourists are scheduled to fly around the moon, I read. And if any politicians are looking to go further than they have done this year, further than the jungle or the airwaves, they may want to consider getting in touch with Elon Musk. And Boris plus one, I'd suggest, for that job. So, we can discuss that. So to tonight's event, many of you have pre-submitted questions. Thank you very much for those, and I'll come to as many of you as I can during the discussion. I hope you're poised. And should any of you want to respond to a point raised, ask another question, disagree with me or disagree with the panel, feel free to disagree with each other as well. Raise your hand and I'll come to you that way. And also, if you get your phones out and go to slido.com, I'm sure many of you have used this many times now, you can go onto that. Slide details on the screen now. You can go onto that, you can ask questions there, and even more excitingly, you can like questions to the top to ensure that we do get to the issues that you want to discuss. And if you're tweeting about the event, do use the same hashtag as well. Right, let's get to the panel, who aren't sitting in the order I expected, but not to worry. We can work around that, and I'm sure the gents operating the microphones could do so as well. So closest to me is Bill Hughes, Head of Real Assets at Legal & General Investment Management. Next to him is Emma Carriaga, Head of Operations at Canada Water for British Land. Then we have Benjamin Lesser, Tour Leader, and development manager for the White Collar Factory at Derwent London. Benjamin took us around the building earlier. And last but by no means least on my far right is Max Farrell, partner at Farrell's Architect. So much going on this year. And let's start with one of the most recent events, which may spell significant change for 2018. Can I start with Joanna Chambers, please? Joanna. The microphone is just finding its way to you.
Good evening. My name is Joanna Chambers from Changing Cities and I'm a planner. I'd just like to ask the panel, the new London plan has just been published, all 500 pages of it. Will it deliver the homes London so desperately needs?
Okay, will the draft London plan deliver the homes London so desperately needs? I did some counting around the London plan last week. There's one mention of real estate, about 30 of property, and then you go up and up and up, and there's about 300 of housing, and I think 1,400 of develop, about one in every 100 words or something ridiculous like that. So there's clearly a development agenda there, Bill, but will it answer London's housing needs?
I very much doubt it. My own view is that there's a couple of really important issues that have been missed by the GLA. I think the powers of the GLA being widened so that the GLA can actually actively buy land would be an important step forward. And the one that really frustrates me is space standards in London. If you're involved in wanting to build high quality with increasing density in urban setting, residential, and in my case I'm talking about build to rent, my own view is that the space standards make that actually quite tough, and the GLA seem intransigent on the subject, which I find personally very disappointing.
they are showing some flexibility there, aren't they, in their dealings with pocket living? Do you not expect that to go further?
Well, I mean, pocket living are an example, and one or two other examples of companies that have addressed this. But if you look at the willingness of the GLA to engage in a broader debate around space standards, they've drawn a line in the sand, and I'm told are not willing to move from where they are. And from my own point of view, I think that's disappointing. We had some plans about modern methods of construction to deliver what we thought would be a very useful contribution to London's housing supply issues, and we're going to have to take that into other cities around the UK.
Okay, thank you. Emma, will the draft London plan solve London's housing crisis?
We've started reading it, but I think it's about 600 pages rather than 500.
Are you saving it for Christmas?
Like you, I'm saving it for Christmas. I've done the word search for Canada Water, which is the project I'm on, and I think we feature half a dozen times, so I've perhaps got less to read than some. I think the interesting thing for me is the sustained commitment to housing. You know, we've heard it from central government in the budget. It's been echoed in the London plan as being kind of the problem to solve. And at some point, one would think, you know, we are finally going to crack it. For me, though, there are some flaws in it that probably the London plan, even if it were on steroids, couldn't resolve. And that's the issue of how you bring forward affordable housing and how you do that at scale. Because that's where the problem lies. London, you know, can build lots of houses, but it needs affordable housing. And for me, there's a massive conflict between the ambition and, you know, where you can achieve it. Public sector land has always been and should always be the obvious place where you can deliver vast amounts of affordable housing. We have done it before, not for many decades, but it has happened and could happen again. But it does need some fundamental changes to the notion of best value, to allow public sector agencies to focus on affordable housing delivery rather than selling land to the highest bidder and simply, you know, exacerbating the problem. So, you know, it's a good go. You know, the budget was a good go, but whether or not it's going to be enough to really crack it, you know, I think there is a bigger problem which possibly the planning system has been left to resolve, but it's deeper and more fundamental than planning.
Okay, I'll come back to the budget shortly, but to flip that question around, Emma, if the London plan in and of itself won't solve the housing crisis, how does the London plan inform what you're going to be doing at Canada Water?
Well, it endorses the Mayor's commitment for growth and generating new employment and housing. And at Canada Water, we've got the fortunate kind of stamp of a housing zone, the stamp of an opportunity area, and everybody seems to be, you know, excited as we are about what it can deliver. So there's no issue as far as we're concerned with us and the London plan. It does everything we want it to and more. I think, you know, the emphasis on opportunity areas is interesting. You know, the Mayor has chosen to focus on concentrating delivery across key locations in London where you are centred around public transport, where there is opportunity to get critical mass and at a pace. And certainly at Canada Water, you know, we've got the land, we've got, you know, supportive local authorities and a supportive GLA. The infrastructure is fortunately there ahead of development, and so we've got all the right ingredients for what we're looking to deliver. So in principle, it's good for us and good for Canada Water. But I think, you know, the housing problem is much greater than opportunity areas on their own can resolve. And so focusing on small builders, focusing on infill sites as the plan seeks to, I think is important. You know, there is also lots of mentions about housing associations and the role that they can play in cracking delivery. You know, they have different motivations, much longer term motivations than most house builders, and so I think they're quite well placed to be relied on to continue to deliver more housing than they do now. So I think, you know, for Canada Water, I think it's a, you know, it's a positive move, but I think, you know, there is still quite a lot of work to do before it can really solve the answer of the housing market in London.
Okay, thank you. And I'll come to you in a moment, Benjamin. But Max, I think in terms of number of mentions, architecture is in there two or three times, but design is in there many more times. Not you know, in the tens, not in the hundreds. Do you think that there's a way of solving this, that design can accelerate some of those solutions?
I think there was a very welcome emphasis on good design and the role it has to play. And I think that you can't really divorce issues of planning from issues of design, and a lot of the things that we've been talking about in terms of density and space standards actually are issues that are just as much about qualitative issues as they are about sort of rules-based issues. And I think one of the welcome things in the London Plan was relaxing the density matrix or doing away with it. But if we're going to do that, then we need to think more creatively about mixed use, because you can't and shouldn't have higher densities without mixed use. The advantage of higher densities is that you can have more integrated retail and other amenities close to where you live. And so if we're going to do that, then maybe we should review the use class system at the same time, and maybe that's something that we need to look at more carefully. And I absolutely agree with you about space standards, and I think that that's something that we need to look more closely at, and it should be something that's more choice-led. And if you go elsewhere in the world, we've got an office in Hong Kong, and I know that minimum space standards definitely don't apply there. My sister lives there in something that resembles a shoebox, but where she lives, all around her is incredible facilities and amenities, and she's happy with where she lives because of that. And so there are examples in the UK, like people live on canal boats, and they certainly don't meet minimum space standards, but people enjoy living there because it's different. And so that's something I think should be looked at more carefully. And then for design issues around daylight and sunlight and how that affects development, particularly as we increase density, I think should be looked at more carefully as well, and distances between buildings. And at the moment, what our guidelines are applied as rules in many boroughs. Actually, we need to. It would be good for the mayor to have a clearer steer on if design can create quality environments that sort of bend the rules, if you like, around daylight and sunlight. Then we should look at that more carefully.
Okay, and Benjamin, looking a bit more broadly than housing, the London Plan, will that help keep London competitive in an attracting talent sense and a delivering a thriving business climate, do you suppose?
I think it's a step in the right direction. I think the London Plan is a refinement, a positive refinement of the previous version, in respect of it actually, you know, differentiates between central London and the suburbs and the outer boroughs. You know, the point of actually thinking about central inner London developments as mixed use, but whether commercially led, not having the residential drive, the implementation there, and actually concentrating much more on residential towards the outer suburban boroughs, I think is the right way, intensifying the core for commercially led schemes. Employment space, and then driving the outer boroughs to meet much more stringent, higher targets for their housing. I think that is a positive refinement. I also think the particular question about, as you mentioned, about use classes, absolutely is way overdue. Town and Country Planning Act of 1948-9 is way out of date. 1947. The way we live and work and use our leisure time is completely different, and they need a complete shake-up, because we are now planning and developing schemes, regeneration schemes, that need to actually talk and relate to the kind of the activities that we do today rather than 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I don't want to dwell on housing all night, but it was the area where we had most questions. So I'll take another one from Leo Petty, just next door.
Good evening. As I'm sure everyone knows, Philip Hammond recently pledged to build 300,000 homes a year in his budget. Firstly, how achievable do you think this target is? And secondly, what are the main problems you can see standing in the way of 300,000 being achieved? Thank you.
Emma, there were some comments on Twitter during the course of those interviews where people were saying, if only the government spent as much time trying to come up with solutions rather than inventing newer, higher targets, we'd get somewhere. But do you have confidence in that being an attainable number?
Well, we have done it, but not for decades. And, you know, the point I made earlier is still the case, that the only time we built that volume of housing was when it was led by local authorities. You know, the housing market doesn't seem to be able to sustain the scale of house building that, you know, the government says that we need, and I think there's a possible question around need. But, you know, if that's the right number, then, you know, it isn't going to happen if we rely on the house builders, developers. You know, there has got to be a huge public sector led house building initiative, and, you know, for that to happen, you know, I do think there has got to be a rethink around what public sector land should be used for. And at the moment, you know, there are lots of agencies with very good intentions, TfL and others, busy promoting sites that are surplus to their requirements, but their imperative is often best value, which is highest highest price. And, you know, density relaxation to one side, that motivation doesn't drive vast numbers of housing for a very broad range of the community. It drives a very specific high density, high value approach to development, which often yields the best value, financial value. So I remain sceptical that it could be achieved whilst we operate the way we operate, and I think the answer is public sector land to be liberated of the need to drive return at the expense of driving best value, which I think we would all agree should be a range of accommodation across a range of tenures for a broader section of the community than can be achieved if you leave development and market forces to do what they do. So it's a tough target. We've never done it other than when public sector led it. And I think, you know, we need to recognise that if that's what we want that volume of homes, then we need to return to the model that delivered it in the first place.
And Max, going back to Leo's question, what do you see as the obstacles in delivering at scale?
I would agree with you, though, about targets, and it's very easy just to kind of increase targets, because that's not the same as coming up with plans, and plans, I think, need to be place-based, and they need to take a particular set of circumstances that apply in a particular area. And that's why I think generic targets and also generic policies are not necessarily the answer. It's more about how you approach a particular place and what that place needs and how you can then deliver it. And I think that more of a partnership approach between the public sector and the private sector is absolutely key. And I think that one of the outcomes of our 1947 Town and Country Planning Act was that it set the private sector and the public sector up as adversaries and poacher and gamekeeper, and that's something that is changing in certain boroughs and in certain city regions, and where it is, then it's making a massive difference, because when it's genuinely a partnership approach, and some of the East London boroughs we're seeing now are acting with developers to bring forward large regeneration projects, and in joint ventures where they put in the land and the developer put in the funding. And where there are areas where there's lower values, then we should look at new construction techniques like modular construction that can keep the construction costs down, and you can deliver more housing in areas where it can be more affordable. And I think we're seeing more and more of that.
Okay, thank you. That's a perfect segue to you, Bill. To what extent can that move the dial?
Modern methods of construction. Yeah, it must be a big part of the solution in the UK. If you look at the numbers at the moment, significantly less than 5% of the housing built in the UK is in modern methods. Look around the world, Japan being probably the best example, a very high percentage off the top of my head, it will be approaching 30 to 40% is built modern methods. And when you get the systems in place, the factories are working, you can build more cost effectively. Importantly, you can build to a higher standard. Mm-hmm. Importantly, you can take employment to places other than where house prices are high. And you can build in a sustainable fashion that is careful about using resources, keeps waste down and the like. And you can, above all else, get houses built more quickly, which I think is part of the equation. The rental market...
Why hasn't it happened yet?
In the UK?
Yeah.
Well, there haven't been organisations other than house builders who've materially invested in it. And the reason house builders are the wrong people to do it is they're very pro-cyclical, which means that they turn the factory on when things are good and they turn it off again. Well, you need a factory to be on all the time, and that's why you need a range of tenures, including build-to-rent, things like hospitals, prisons, schools, student accommodation, social housing, and a bit of build-to-sell as well. And if you get an order book that is wide enough, then it's sustainable, it's predictable, and you can keep the factory running. And, you know, I've been around factories in Japan that are throwing out 8,000 units per month, and it's just a phenomenal thing to see. And the reason they can do it, technology exists, there's no problem with the technology here, it's absolutely proven. The only trick, really, is building an order book that is sustainable so the factory keeps going. And in the UK, I think one of the concerns has been the stigma associated with terrapins, prefabrication, you know, the John Prescott £60,000 homes, all of that stuff. And actually, one of the things we're doing is to try and address that stigma by saying, well, actually, you can put a warranty on it, so you can say this will survive at least 60 years. You can get a mortgage on it. And the banks are really engaging in that process. You can have a build off-site property assurance system in place. And all of these things can be done because the quality can be built, actually, in my view, better than traditional methods. And the house builders don't like to talk about it very much because it disturbs their business model, and they're all about house price inflation and small volumes. Well, we need to be about much bigger volumes and do things that actually get in the way of house price inflation, and then there'll be more homes. The target of 300,000 is utterly ridiculous. And the reason I say that is it's meaningless. It doesn't make any difference at all. And all of the manifestos in the last election, every single political party came up with a number somewhere around 250, 300. So, you know, there's no news in that at all. What there needs to be, though, I agree with the comment about land. There needs to be a grown-up approach to public land contributing, and there definitely needs to be a more grown-up industry in the UK about modern methods, because then you can build at scale, quality, and the rest of it.
OK, thank you. We'll have to move on. We've got a lot to get through. Gary Smith. Just at the back there.
Hi. Does the panel see the trend in forest investment in London continuing into next year? And if not, who's going to take up the slack?
Okay. Benjamin, can you call the big buyers of 2018?
I think the stats are showing that, you know, the trend will continue from... Well, it increased through 17 and it will continue through 18 from the Far East, from China. And in fact, you know, as China maybe closes some door to that outward investment. You know, there'll be more coming from Hong Kong as a sort of a sliding of funds from mainland China to Hong Kong to then to London. And then I think in the next 12 to 24 months, there'll be other players in the Far East as well. Maybe, you know, Japan, sovereign wealth funds from Japan will be competing as well as closer to home, Germany, and others.
It sounds like there's a wall of money waiting to come here. Is the overall quantum going to increase, or is it just going to get more competitive?
Cool. I think it will become more competitive. The volumes of investment trading that's happened. I mean, there are probably people here who can speak on this better than I can in terms of stats. But you know, the volume is immense and it's growing. And I think as the world continues on its slightly precarious path in many different parts of the world, London is, you know, the fundamentals, as probably been said, you know, many, many times before, but the fundamentals still remain here in London. It is a very good, safe place to invest. And that's what people are looking for.
Okay. Bill, do you see the same level of money coming from the Far East, and do you see more coming from elsewhere as well?
Broadly speaking, I think the attraction of London as an investment destination is in a good place, and I think that will be maintained. I think it's a little bit difficult to say whether or not it'll be predominantly from China, Hong Kong, or Japan, or the Middle East, but or other parts of the world. But the scale of the city, which is still actually a small city in terms of the aggregate side of London compared to, say, the Chinese cities, plus the fact that it's got enduring appeal, transparency, legal ownership, professionalism, I think it will endure. Of course, there is a point at which price becomes unaffordable, and London, I think, is at risk of affordability issues compared to other cities around the UK. So if I have a prediction about it, I think there'll be more capital from overseas looking for non-London investments, but London will continue to be attractive.
And is it harder for you as a domestic investor to commit capital in the same way that perhaps you have done in the past?
I think the answer to it is, rather than outbid all the capital that comes to London from around the world for existing assets, we tend to be more about creating the assets we want to own, and most overseas capital can't do that.
Okay, and is that in London or is that increasingly outside?
It's in all cities around the UK, and including London. But we're doing a lot in Cardiff, Newcastle, Leeds, Manchester, and we've got three or four other cities that we're about to announce new regeneration projects in as well.
Okay, thank you. Alex Tong had a connected question towards the front, I'm afraid.
Hi, similar question. Do foreign investors still see commercial real estate in London as a safe harbour, given we're experiencing Brexit?
Okay. And so, Emma, is there a risk of some of that capital going elsewhere? As much as overseas investors are looking at London, they're presumably looking at other cities increasingly.
Well, I mean, I think in terms of our experience of 2017, you know, we've done very well out of international investment looking to place its capital in London, and you could argue that this has been the year of uncertainty. So despite that, there has been sustained confidence in London and it as an investment proposition. I mean, I'd echo, you know, what the panel said already about a sense of London being, a long-term sensible play. It's got a sense of fairness, a good stock. It's got a relatively sound kind of governance regime. And if Sadiq can pull it off, you know, hopefully some independence for London going forward. So I don't see that changing. I think, you know, it would be wrong for any of us to sit here and crystal ball about what 2018 will bring. You probably know as much as I do, but I think if you believe in the fundamentals of London and look at our track record relative to the uncertainty around it, it's survived and feels to me anyway certainly fairly resilient to whatever life throws at it.
Okay, thank you. And Max, I can imagine MIPIM in March, you know, Paris will be relabeled a Brexit-free zone. The German cities will be ever more aggressive and competitive in their marketing. The clients you talk to, are they increasingly looking at other parts of the world?
No, not from our experience at all. And I was in Hong Kong last week and I had meetings on three UK projects, each of which was... two in London, one 10,000 homes in Enfield and one 15,000 homes in Barking and another in Manchester for 16,000 homes. And these are all projects that are ramping up. And I think that what we saw with ABP 5-6 years ago when they made that commitment to London, they were the sort of trailblazers, if you like, and their commitment never faltered whether when we had the mayoral elections and Brexit. And we're on site now building the first phase of Royal Albert Dock, which is for Asian companies to come and locate and in London. That interest is only increasing. I think we're only at the very beginning of that, in fact. And the project, that presents lots of opportunities because the areas that I've talked about, in particular in terms of the residential, these are areas where it's the values are sort of £400 to £500 a square foot. So the type of housing will be middle of the market housing. But they're also joint ventures with local authorities and also joint ventures with UK-based developers and contractors. So ABP partnering with Brookfield and ASF embarking with Lendlease and so on. So I think there's increasing interest in investment, and I think that the key thing for us is to start to understand the cultural differences, particularly the Chinese. It's a very different way of doing things, and we've had the advantage of having an office in Hong Kong for 30 years and understanding the way they work, and which is quite different, but at the same time, they think long term, and they also understand the value of creating social amenities and infrastructure, and also spending money upfront on transport infrastructure to create value. And so I think for those reasons, there's a lot to be optimistic about.
Okay, thank you. And Bill, did the government get that top question there? Will HMRC CGT proposal have a significant effect on pricing? Do you think that will go ahead, and will it be depressive?
Well, I think if you read what was in the announcement, and if you reflect on what the government is trying to achieve, I think the proposal as it's currently drafted will either get better understood or watered down or a bit of both. Because my understanding is it was expressly about targeting high net worth, speculative investment, and largely about residential as well. It never was about deterring long-term sovereign wealth pension fund money. And if you look at where the exemptions actually lie, long-term capital coming into London, into the UK, will not be adversely affected in a material fashion. So I think actually the market reaction about that particular issue, about CGT on overseas, non-DOM, has been a little bit overblown, but that's because I think the government announced it very badly.
Are you confident the drafting will avoid unintended consequences?
Well, there's always a risk of that. I'm going to spend some time on the subject of unintended consequences, and I have a few meetings coming up. So, look, I think the government is not particularly keen to see unintended consequences either, so it's up to us to articulate that.
Okay, thank you. Chris Lamb.
Hi, Chris Lamb from Design Southeast. Do you think now is the time to think about the wider London City region, by which I mean an area that stretches way beyond the GLA boundary, as a single entity and one that needs a coherent plan to face a changing world?
So we'd have to rename this London City Region Question Time. Benjamin, is it time for that?
I think it is, actually. I think there needs to be much more strategic level thinking that does go beyond the current boundaries of London, goes to a more, somewhere in between a city and a national level. Then it definitely needs to be more strategic and beyond. I mean, even on the basis of speed of travel, so much more now is in the hinterland of central London just by means of time rather than distance. So distance is in many respects becoming secondary to actually, the time factor. And the more, the more infrastructure is built and delivered and used, the more that becomes relevant, I think.
Okay, Emma?
Well, I mean, I do agree. I'm slightly hesitant because we have been there with regional governance before and it didn't end well for lots of people. But I do accept that with Crossrail and other major transport improvements, London is suddenly very small. And, you know, with land values and house prices and what have you, the need for people to live further out and be able to access and move to and from a much wider region is undoubtedly going to be part of the solution to the crisis. Whether or not, you know, that can be done, how you join the GLA up with those kind of county shires all around it, you know, who knows. But conceptually, London does do a fair amount of bidding for a much greater geographical area already, whether or not it needs the sort of governance and infrastructure to really promote itself properly as a region.
And there, you know, is a direction.
I think you're right, actually.
There is a direction of travel there. Regional governments haven't always ended well, perhaps in London, I presume you're referring to. The West Midlands Combined Authority is making great strides, yes. Greater Manchester too.
Yeah, you know, there's some good examples, and, you know, city mayors have had a big part to play in that as well. You know, I think if you subscribe to London and the South East being the engine for the UK, you know, the more it can do to support itself, you know, the better. So I definitely think that transport is probably going to necessitate London being much more than just the 33 London boroughs. But you've got to persuade those counties of Kent, Surrey and Sussex to join the party.
OK, you mentioned city mayors. I think we should deal with that. Tim Reid.
Sorry, I'm not very good at shouting. So, hello, Tim Reid, for Communications. Question on Steve Khan, so back to London Mayor. We're sort of a year and a half on now. What's the panel's reflections on what he's done well for property and what could he do better? I think particularly a nod to the London plan last week in the sense that lots of good ideas, but actually will they be realistically executed?
Max, I used to take it personally when he'd very politely turned down our invitation to appear on panels, but he's not appeared on many, if any, property-related panels. Is he doing enough for property?
I think he's very different. It couldn't be more different to the previous mayor. And I think that there's an opportunity for him there to kind of... one of the real tricks that Boris missed was, and it goes back to this point on the regional planning, was about the airport debate and how actually if we thought more strategically about Gatwick and the impact that would have on having a second runway there on the regeneration of South London and frame that whole the airport debate in that way, then I think that's an opportunity for the mayor to actually kind of stake his authority on something that could make a big difference in terms of regional planning. But yeah, he hasn't really kind of committed much to developments in a high-profile way in the way that his predecessor did. And I think that sooner or later he's going to have to.
I was going to say, is there an opportunity cost to that? Does it matter? Does he need to personally if he has effective deputy mayors?
Yeah, well, I think that the more leadership there is, the better, and the more championing of important big projects and making sure that they get all the support that they need and working with boroughs to make that happen, and so having some flexibility around policies as well. You know, I think these policies around strategic industrial land and retaining or no net loss of floor space is all good and well, but we need to think more flexibly in areas like Enfield, for example, where there's an entire corridor that's mainly industrial uses that can be regenerated and could be a big part of the solving London's housing crisis. But, you know, we don't want the policies to get in the way of that happening if there's a more creative way of doing sort of intensification and integrated residential and industrial uses, for example.
Okay, thank you. And Bill, what would be your end-of-term report for Sadiq?
Not engaging with us, I think, is definitely an observation, which I think is disappointing. I don't much like his his strong arm approach to affordable. I think the bigger picture, and as we've talked about, is how you procure housing rather than make some rigid lines about what percentage is affordable. Going back to the question of the airport side of things, I think this is a really interesting point. The debate should never have been about Boris saying Boris Island, will it be Gatwick or will it be Heathrow? It should never have been that. It should always have been, and I like the question about London having a more expansive view, a wider canvas. The debate should have been about in which order will we use Stansted better, will we expand Gatwick, will we do Heathrow, and if someone wants to build Boris Island, it used to be called Maplin Sands in the 1970s, nothing's ever new, then that's another thing to do. But London will deserve a lot more airport capacity, and it should never have been a debate about one or the other. That was thoroughly misguided. And the reason is because people get fixated on politics that is too local rather than a city region and thinking about what does a city actually require. So I think your question is very good. Go to the West Midlands for a second. You know, the debate about Solihull and Birmingham, who haven't ever agreed about what do you do about the land between NEC and what will be the new HS2 terminal and the city, is because Solihull and Birmingham disagree on things. The West Midlands Combined Authority is going to be able to, I think, unlock that opportunity because it's got a bigger canvas.
Because it's got a strong, visible, engaged mayor, perhaps?
Well, Andy Street's got his own challenges. Will he be able to bring it together? I think he's got a good chance. But actually, he's got a chance to get Solihull and Birmingham, rather, working together rather than in opposition to each other. And that should be for the benefit of both.
OK, thank you. Emma, a question has popped up there. I expect the person who's asked that question, his name isn't really Boris, I'm guessing. Does London need a new airport? Sorry, Boris, if that is your name.
Where is he? He must be out there somewhere. I think we need multiple expansions at all our airports. I think, you know, if London is to be able to attract and continue to attract people from, you know, the Far East, the Middle East, Europe, and just kind of maintain its position on the world stage, I think we get a really bum deal as far as airport capacity goes. And, you know, I think if you look around the world, all of us travel, you know, we experience world-class facilities in capital cities all around the world, and London is not getting its fair share of that. Whether or not that's it's, I don't think it's a matter of Heathrow versus Gatwick or Stansted versus anywhere else. I think there needs to be a general consensus, cross-party, I might add, that London deserves more air capacity, airport capacity, and for convenience and ease of customer experience and attracting airline investment. And inward investment, it isn't a case of just a single solution being the answer, but moreover, expansion at a number of key locations that suit people for different types of travel.
And what are the consequences if that doesn't happen?
Well, I think there are, despite Brexit, you know, good evidence of London losing out in terms of airport capacity to other European hubs. Schiphol is always cited as being one that does very well. And, you know, I think we're missing a trick, you know, and if we're not going to make a sustained investment into our European rail network, the reliance on other forms of transport continues, and we are doing ourselves a disservice without making our airports the world-class service for customers and international investment that they should be.
OK, let's stick with transport and infrastructure for a moment. David Williams.
Hello, David.
The microphone will find you, David. Do use the microphone, please. I haven't told the panel we're recording this.
Well, that's just as well, Mr. Well. My question, I'll sit down, is if in this gorgeous world where we had the availability of Crossrail 1 and 2, at the same time, they were both completed. Imagine, both completed. Would London's infrastructure still be inadequate?
Benjamin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Well, Well, we know for starters that Crossrail 1, at least, you know, it will just about, you know, it's lagging way behind the requirement for providing capacity. By the time Crossrail 2, and I don't think there is a date on it, because by the time we get to Crossrail 2, I expect it to be the same situation, that it will be lagging far behind the capacity required. We always seem to be doing, even at this very station, Old Street Station, which has been banded as, you know, Tech City, Silicon Roundabout. You know, if you actually look at the infrastructure here, it is unbelievably out of date and way under capacity. You know, every evening there are thousands of people at that station trying to use it. So, again, it's 10 years behind where it should be. We seem to have this habit in this country of taking far too, you know, Heathrow for one being the other example. I think, you know, with the inward investment, with the draw and the pull of London in terms of drawing in talent from all over the world, I could say the likelihood is, just by experience to date, we will always be lagging behind the required capacity, but those projects, those major infrastructure projects, will, you know, go a long way to help, and they are, you know, they're way beyond. They should have been delivered way earlier than they have been. We'll just have to wait, but you know, it will make a step change for experience, the experience of living and working in London.
Okay, Max, are you any more optimistic that we'll catch up with demand?
Well, I think if we are going to, then what we need to do is start thinking about that now. Because I think the problem is we've always been far too reactive, and in particular when it comes to planning around infrastructure and the opportunities around infrastructure. And the sooner you start thinking about it and creating a vision and talking about it, then the sooner it starts becoming a reality in people's minds. And also being joined up in terms of different transport networks. And it's interesting that you mentioned the fact that we have a lot of airports already in the wider London region, but what we don't have is a good network that actually connects them all up and the trains with the planes, if you like. One of the big missed opportunities that you and I, David, know all about is the Crossrails, having a Crossrail station at City Airport, which was a huge missed opportunity, which we hope still might happen. But that then would connect City with Heathrow. And when you start thinking in that way, then you can have we already have 7 runways in the wider London region. It's just a question of them being better joined up. But just to give you one anecdote about sort of thinking in a more visionary way about infrastructure and how that actually then can make it happen, is we came across an idea in Barking and Dagenham, which was an idea that was dreamt up by the leader of the borough, which was about burying a large portion of the A13, the major trunk road coming in from Essex, in order to build homes and new housing in Barking, and also connect the north of the borough with the river. But it had always been based on a number of homes which didn't make it viable. But when we started thinking about high-density housing there and 15,000 homes rather than 3,000 homes, then it became a more viable thing to do. And that's now become a credible scheme that we've taken to the mayor and we've got funding potentially now for. But also what it meant is we started thinking about there as an overground station that could be there on the North London line. But now we're thinking about connecting that up with the C2C. And potentially, and we've got Chinese investors, and they like to do the big picture thinking about what's possible. At the moment, HS1 freight arrives there. There's no reason in the future why, with 40,000 new homes being planned for Barking, you couldn't connect HS1 with a C2C and the North London line there at that station hub. But as soon as you start talking about that and thinking about it, and the other kind of even more left field thing about that project is the fact that the freight train arrives there from China now. It takes 2 weeks and it travels along the old Silk Road route. And there's no reason why that couldn't, first of all, be converted to passenger use. And that would be a very nice 2-week journey throughout Europe and the Middle East to arrive in China. But what we're talking about now with our Chinese clients is how we could make that route high speed.
and that would make the whole of the One Belt, One Road, a high-speed rail project, which would take 2 days to get from China to Barking. So all of those things, once you start thinking about them in those terms, even if it seems totally unfeasible right now, if people start talking about it and thinking about it, then you start thinking about what might be possible and think differently about that area as well.
China to Barking, I can see the tourist literature now. Bill, these are real assets. How big is your appetite for investing in this sort of infrastructure?
We certainly see ourselves as being an investor in what I would call infrastructure, and that's economic infrastructure, of which transportation and energy are the two main types. Huge funding gap with renewables, that's got to be a big part of the future. So we do think about real assets in its totality. Just to respond to David's question about Crossrail 1 and 2, will it ever be enough? I'd pause for a second and think about what we're trying to do here. If the intention is to pour more and more people into London, more and more millions, what do you actually think is going to happen to London as a city? I think actually the way to think about it is to say, can other locations be useful? Are there other places where people might want to live, work and play, other than just try and get more and more people into what is a tight city, much of which won't change, number one. Number two, the thing we don't talk about very much is when there are driverless cars, the capacity for the road network to get more people in and out of cities is demonstrably, really materially, much, much higher. And I think, actually, the thing we should be thinking about now, and I know they're thinking about it in West Midlands, is thinking about what sort of investment would you need to be making for driverless cars to be effective about getting in and out of cities. For me, that would be a more useful thing to do than think about Crossrail 3.
OK, thank you. A question at the front.
Well, just to point out, I had common themes on housing and infrastructure, procurement of sites, getting on with things. To me, there's a greater role for the state to play following sort of regional and national policies so that we can procure these sites. Then we can hand it over to Bill and the like. There's tons of cash out there, domestic and international, and we're missing out on opportunity. And when money is at such historically low rates, we can catch up on decades of underinvestment. But I think the state needs to play a stronger role initially.
OK, thank you. We're up against the clock, and I did want to get a couple of last quick issues in. Wale Sanusi.
Evening, everyone. Wale Sanusi, Contour. So I'm hoping that the answers to this question can hopefully help provide me with some good primary research for my dissertation and also benefit any landlords and agents in the room. So for landlords, it's obvious that the recent influx for office take-up being driven by startups is good news. But there's one major problem, covenant. More specifically, the fact that startups don't really have good covenants and they struggle to meet the tests in order to pass those assessments, which is looking at previous year's accounts. So my question is, have startups made the traditional methods of assessing covenant redundant? Thank you.
Emma, about 1,500 words on this, I'm sure, would be most helpful.
We're an owner of real estate across London, which tends to be concentrated in campuses. We've got Broadgate, Regent's Place and Paddington, and, in the not-too-distant future, the fourth one at Canada Water. And what makes those places good is good quality, stable income. But what makes them great is to have a real diversity of businesses there, all feeding off one another and making London the fantastic capital it is. And if those are all big corporates, not necessarily bad corporates, but big corporates with great covenant strength, I think we meet the first test of being kind of, good in terms of filling space. But they're not great, and it's the startups that you mentioned that bring the diversity, and interestingly, is what the big corporates want to be around. There has been in London, a trend which you'll no doubt have read about of businesses wanting to be like others and alongside others, and that's definitely changed in London. You know, the days where lawyers want to be surrounded by their peers is long gone. And so we're desperately keen to see startups and small SMEs part of our campus developments. And we've developed a product called Story, which is our own sort of serviced office, if you like, product, which is aimed at exactly that market, you know, small and medium-sized businesses who want to take space for a small period of time, maybe to see how it goes and expand over time. And, you know, we have the ability to do that with scale and with a campus. And it's certainly what our longer standing customers say they want in terms of like-minded but different, if you see what I mean, businesses that they want to sit alongside. So it can be done, it should be done. We've got the advantage perhaps of having scale and the luxury of being able to have a closer look at covenant strength, which may in the first instance not pass the test, but through a product we've developed which is aimed at exactly that market, we're trying it out and on a number of campuses have seen some really encouraging results.
Okay,
so
thank you.
With the dissertation, by the way.
And the podcast will be available. And Benjamin, a related question. How do you value buildings where the majority tenant or a significant tenant is a serviced office provider?
I think, the fundamental there is, would we ever have a building where the majority tenant is a serviced office provider? I think we always see it as a proportion that we'd like, a desirable proportion, as it were. So here at White Collar Factory, the office group have taken 3 floors out of the 15. So that for us is a comfortable proportion. I don't think we'd ever get to a stage where it's rising above anything more than, you know, that kind of rough percentage. And as Emma said, you know, it's definitely about creating this ecosystem, and you know, the methods of valuation are definitely going to be changing to suit the new occupier environment. And for us, you know, it's less about the covenant strength; it's more about actually analysing cash flows repeatedly, closely monitoring those, understanding exactly where the company is going and their memberships and their business models, and keeping a close eye on it. And that's a close dialogue, which I think is also part of the changing environment. That actually, you know, there's much more of a relationship and a dialogue with our customers.
Okay, thank you. One last quick question, then the panel's big finale, which I haven't warned them about at all. Senya Svalina. Thank you. The microphone's just coming.
We have a perfect gentleman here, an architect, to be for myself to be addressing this question, and which is, what will the workspace model look like in the next 50 years? Considering the huge environmental costs of the transport costs, especially on the global environment. Thank you.
So, Max, what would
so
the workplace look...
So very delighted that Canada water lady is so highly intelligent, so very pleased to be in her company as well. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'll start with Max, and then as Senya was so complimentary about you, Emirat, I'll come to you next. But Max, what will the workplace look like in 50 years, was the question.
Yeah.
But take 10.
I think it
would
look more less obviously like a workplace. I think one of the great things about here is when you go upstairs and there's a courtyard with low-rise buildings arranged around it, it feels like you're in a residential situation. And like on the flip side of that, at ABP, we've got, in Royal Albert Dock, we've got terraced office buildings. Partly because it's a cultural thing and the Chinese occupiers want to have their own office building with their own entrance, and so that was a design challenge in terms of making that more efficient and stripping out services and that kind of thing. But it's more about the impact of technology and how we want to live our lives and actually blurring the lines between work and not work, if you like, because these days we're all working outside of the office, and it's not. It needs to be somewhere where you can meet and congregate and have the right kind of interactions with people. But it certainly won't be somewhere where I don't think you'll have your own desk. And I think those days are long gone.
even for architects, you know, we definitely don't have drawing boards anymore. I think so. It's about blurring the lines, and also digital and technology being ever present. And you know, the big thing that we're looking at these days, whether it's retail or commercial or hotels, is about experiential, and it's about the merging of the physical with the digital, and how that can sort of change the landscape and change how people interact with space. I think is going to be important, whilst also retaining a sort of human feel and a human scale. So quite okay. What that's going to look like, I don't know.
Emma, what is it going to look like?
I've got no idea. But, you know, I think one thing's got to be right, that everybody still wants to be with other people, because, you know, if you follow and track technological change, you could say, why do we need offices? Why does anybody need to build more real estate? We can do it all virtually. We can do it all online. But we all want to work alongside other people. You know, if you look at why people come to do business, come to do stuff together, it is that human interaction, and I don't think that'll change. What will it look like? Not very different from what it looks like today. You know, the idea that you can create a great kind of space like we're in here and like Derwent and British Land, and we've all created. You know, there's some great buildings in London, and, you know, I still see office development alive and kicking for decades to come. I think the model will be possibly much more stripped back. You know, the space we're in today, 10 years ago, would have been unfinished, right? You know, the idea of kind of breeze blocks and exposed steel beams that, you know, we're all sitting looking at presumably as a finished building, but, you know, a few years ago would have not been the case. More of this on a typical office floor, I would say, would be the prediction for the office of the future, but it'll still be, you know, fundamentally quite true to what we all know.
Okay, thank you. I promised a big finale. So from each of you, you can take this one in the second, Benjamin, as part of your answer. But from each of you, not a song and dance routine, unless you choose to, Bill, but a big, bold, and fairly brief prediction for 2018.
About the property market?
One about the property market. You can have one on anything else.
I think the property market next year will show signs of fragility around the occupier market in a way that we haven't really seen this year. But I think because we've talked about the attraction of London and the UK, I think capital will continue to see it as being an investment destination that's worth pursuing. And because of all of that, I think there will be a bigger difference between winners and losers than we've been used to.
Okay, Max.
I think hopefully there'll be a much bigger focus on collaborations between public and private sector. I think that has to happen in order to bring forward more development. And also much more intensification of space and mixed use will be more radical, I hope. And I think that's the way that we're heading. Low-level bridges in East London, which I forgot to mention, but it would be remiss of me not to, is that we need more connectivity along the river in East London, and I think that would be hopefully something that will change. And England will win the World Cup.
Okay. There we go. So, fragility, more bridges, and wild optimism. Benjamin. You can have a comment on the workspace.
Yes, just to clarify, this is actually shell space. This is to be fitted out. There's a really exciting restaurant operator coming in here over the next six, nine months to fit out into something called the Long Table. So I implore you all to come and enjoy basically a whole series of different food and drink offerings here that will be here as of next summer.
I think that's an invitation to lunch, isn't it?
Yes, come and enjoy. So, but back to 2018, I think definitely in the context of that potential fragility and in the context of, you know, there will, that will definitely differentiate winners and losers, I think there must be a continuous and even more acute focus on what it is that we are doing as developers, as suppliers of space, whether it's living space or workspace or leisure space, cultural space, you know, because we cannot afford to get it wrong. We have to actually think about it from the user's perspective, from the occupier's perspective, about the experience, take a lead from many other, all other industries, in fact, and think about the customer rather than from the investor's end of the telescope, to actually think about what it is we are creating, because we have to get it right. We haven't got sufficient resources to get it wrong. And in the longer term, long-term value of those assets that we are hopefully going to be generating, it has to be right for the longer term.
Okay, thank you. And Emma?
Well, apart from Tottenham winning the Premiership, which you know must be a dead cert, I would like London to have a seat at the table internationally, advocating for the role we need to play in the Brexit debate. And securing a fair deal for the capital. I think, you know, it's been long overdue. I think we've been left out of the party. And I think there's been rumblings about it over the last few days, and I want that to continue.
OK, thank you. We're out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to our partners, ABP London, Leo, Maples, Teasdale, you and I, and Derwent London for hosting us. For those of you who didn't make the tour but still want to see the building, there will be an exciting new enhanced building tour with the developer and architect on EG in January. So look out for that. But a special thanks to our panel, and join me in thanking them.